Muy buenas tardes a todos. Vamos a iniciar este workshop Beyond on Evidence. Vorrei farlo, dico in italiano, soprattutto per i nostri ospiti che ci accompagnano, che vengono da diverse parti dell'Europa, però tutti di origine italiana. Un po' è stato a caso, no? Prometto che non è stata la ragione della scelta, però è venuto così. Benvenuti a Girona, siamo molto contenti di avervi qua e di poter discutere questi due giorni con tutti voi su questo argomento, diciamo il ragionamento probatorio che qua a Girona è molto stimato, diciamo, è un argomento che ci interessa molto e da molto tempo, quindi saremmo molto contenti di ospitarvi, poter discutere su queste cose. Diego Dei Vecchi è il nostro primer ponente, postdoc Juan de la Cierva hasta hace 4 días aquí en Girona y ahora postdoc de la Cátedra de Cultura Jurídica. Todas las ponencias las tendremos en inglés, según fue acordado, aunque también dadas todas nuestras procedencias, creo que los debates pueden ser multilingües perfectamente, si así quieren preguntar en español, en italiano o en alemán, que Diego conoce muy bien. Así que, sin más preámbulos, damos la palabra a Diego para el inicio de la primera de las ponencias.
Gracias, Jordi. Bueno, buenas tardes, buonasera. Presentaré en inglés el texto, lo leeré para tratar de ser menos oscuro y tratar de adecuarme a los tiempos. Bueno, muchas gracias por la posibilidad de estar aquí, por la posibilidad de participar en este seminario. Gracias al BIAP por la organización junto con la Cátedra de Cultura Jurídica. Y bueno, sin más, doy inicio a la lectura de mi texto. This paper presents a criticism of some of Larry Loudon's ideas about legal epistemology. Loudon has developed different lines of research in the field of legal epistemology, leading his philosophical efforts to analyze how decisions concerning the sufficiency of evidence are made in our criminal justice systems. Errors, their frequency, and their consequences are at the core of his concerns, particularly the kind of errors he calls false verdicts, to wit, verdicts whose factual premise is false. I would prefer to say wrong, but Loudon used the word false. He distinguishes two types of false verdicts. On the one hand, convictions against innocent people, also known as false positives or false convictions, and on the other, acquittals in favor of guilty defendants, also known as false negatives or false acquittals. False negatives may arise from a prosecutor's decision to drop charges or can stem from a false verdict after the trial has ended. I will focus here on Loudon's analysis of false negatives after the trial, as a consequence of the trial. To decide if a defendant should or should not be convicted after a trial, legal systems resort to specific tools, the supposed function of which is to satisfy two needs. First, to set the threshold of evidence for accepting factual propositions as true, and to act in response of this acceptance or rejection, convicting or acquitting defendants. And the second function is to distribute the errors involved when deciding and acting in this way, the errors, the false positives and false negatives. One of these essential tools is the standard of proof, that is a general norm establishing the threshold of proof to convict in criminal trials. Loudon thinks that the higher the demand of evidence, the lower the number of false convictions, but at the same time, this increases the number of false acquittals, Symmetrically, the lower the standard of proof, the higher the number of false convictions. However, the number of false acquittals diminishes and punishment for the guilty increases. The distribution of error employing a standard of proof consists precisely in setting a threshold of evidence, the outcomes of which should reflect a moral judgment on the importance of both types of error. Indeed, in Loudon's view, the role of the criminal justice system is to implement the part of the social contract regarding the correct distribution between false positives and false negatives. The phrase beyond a reasonable doubt, the formula beyond a reasonable doubt, hereafter BART for short, has been accepted in many different criminal justice systems as the proper formula to set out the standard of proof. The hope is that the formula successfully sets a threshold of evidence which, when applied, reflects a value judgment in which convicting an innocent person is worse than acquitting a guilty one. It is often alleged that BART instantiates the so-called Blackstone's ratio, 10 false acquittals for every single conviction. Loudon has argued a great deal in favor of abandoning BART. He has provided two main reasons. Let me call Loudon's first claim against BART the Confucian thesis, as it sets out that BART unacceptably confounds epistemic reasons with subjective confidence. And epistemic reasons, to use Peter Strawson's vocabulary, are the only right sort of reasons to accept, to justify the acceptance of factual propositions. This would be so what I call the Confucian thesis. The second claim against BART is that it leads to a massive number of false acquittals. The argument here is twofold. On the one hand, Loudon claims that BART admits more false acquittals than a rational legal system would tolerate, given that, in Loudon's moral view, Blackstone's ratio is not only groundless but also pernicious. Let me call this claim the consequentialist thesis, since the pernicious character of BART lies in its potentially harmful consequences. On the other hand, according to Loudon, not only does BART tolerate too many false acquittals in light of its underlying justification, that is, the Blackstone's ratio, but the main problem seems to be that it generates many more false acquittals than even the Blackstone's ratio tolerates. Then BART fails even in the light of its underlying justification. Indeed, Loudon claims that because of the application of the BART standard, the US criminal justice system acquits after trial between 75 and 85 of guilty defendants. Let me call this claim the failure thesis. I will focus on this facet of Loudon too many false acquittals claim in the failure thesis. Although I will argue that the Confucian thesis and the failure thesis appear to be inconsistent, my main point is not to make this inconsistency explicit. Loudon's apparent inconsistency is just a touchstone to argue that the failure thesis must be rejected, showing what the failure thesis requires not to be inconsistent with the Confucian thesis, reveals that Loudon's reasoning in favor of the failure thesis is unacceptable. I will argue that this claim is groundless and that arguments of this kind concerning US and or any other legal system should be rejected. I'll proceed in three steps. First, I will recreate Loudon Confucian thesis, then I will redepict Loudon failure thesis with a few quotes. Finally, I will argue that Loudon's failure thesis is either inconsistent with the Confucian thesis or more probably groundless. So, the Confucian thesis. In 2003, Loudon published an illuminating article, many of the conclusions of which were included in the second chapter of the book he published 3 years later. In both works, Loudon points out that BART constitutes an empty formula, both an epistemic threshold of evidence and an expression of a particular moral ratio of the error distribution. This emptiness is due primarily to its radical subjectivism. Although Loudon does not formulate the point exactly in this way, I believe we can distinguish a few nuances in this subjectivism. Indeed, Loudon begins his battle against Bard by setting down a repertory of interpretations of the formula made by judges and scholars in the US throughout history. However, interpretation is not the only nor the most critical problem for our purposes. The main problem is that those interpretations are not genuine conceptions of proof, given that the threshold is not defined in terms of epistemic reasons at all, but merely as the particular state of mind the triers of fact must find themselves experiencing. In light of this, one interpretation of Bard is particularly relevant to our purposes, the one that interprets Bard in probabilistic terms, as a high degree of probability. According to Loudon, this interpretation is much more popular among legal scholars and the public than among judges. Although it is not the only way to understand probability, Loudon takes for granted, that when this locution is used to explain a standard of proof, it is understood as a specific degree of confidence where complete subjective certainty is tantamount to the top of the scale, probability of 100%. Now, the fact that the probabilistic interpretation of Bard leads to uncontrollable subjectivism becomes apparent not in Loudon's first article about Bard, but a few years later in his 2006 book, when he discusses the possibility of establishing any standard of proof employing probabilistic vocabulary. Loudon rejects this possibility, given two main reasons. The first regards the difficulties in assigning specific probabilities to beliefs where the events at stake are non-statistical, such as the events to be decided not only in judicial process, but also in other areas of empirical investigation. This estimation, he says, is not something that I or most jurors could do with any degree of reliability. End of the quote. The second reason, and the most important, is that any standard of proof formulated in terms of probabilities would not be a standard of proof at all. This point is at the core of what I have called the Confucian thesis. Loudon says, this is a travesty system of proof. Instead of specifying that the juror's level of confidence in guilt should depend on whether a robust proof has been offered, the criminal law makes the standard of proof parasitic on the inquirer's, that is, the juror's level of confidence in the defendant's guilt. We have proof, says the law, so long as jurors are strongly persuaded of the guilt of the accused, or so long as they will assign it a probability greater than X, where X is the probabilistic standard of proof. Never mind how they arrived at their high confidence, we have proof. This gets things precisely backwards. What Loudon is saying here is that this kind of distortion swaps the threshold of evidence for a state of mind that should have been justified by an independent body of evidence. One more quote. So long as definitions of Bard fail to address the robustness of evidence, and so long as they remain fixated purely on the strength of the juror's belief, Bard will remain open to the devastating criticism that it confuses mere strength of belief, which may be widely irrational, with warranted belief. End of the quote. Under this understanding of Bard, Loudon's argument is sound, as there is no guarantee that the degree of confidence felt by the trier of fact, or whoever else, covariates with the evidence he or she had at hand. I think that even if Loudon does not make this explicit, the most important lesson this provides is that the only way to corroborate this contingent covariation would be by contrasting the relevant available evidence. Let us assume then, for the sake of argument, that Loudon's Confucian thesis is sound regarding any probabilistic standard of proof, and in any case regarding Bard. Then we should consider his failure thesis. One of Loudon's most persistent and wholly justified worries in legal epistemology has been the absence of empirical evidence showing the real ratio of error the criminal legal system produces when deciding on facts. He points out that not serious research method can be indifferent about its reliability or about how often it leads to error. Nevertheless, sadly, the legal system is both simultaneously ignorant and indifferent regarding these matters. Under these circumstances, Loudon devised a way of waking citizens up by making the real rate of error explicit. As a result, he found that this rate deviated considerably given the enormous number of false acquittals the system produces. In his 2006 book, Loudon does not risk any categorical claim about the rate of false acquittals, though he presents some speculations. However, more recently, he has been trying to go further to verify the rate of false verdicts, especially the kind of false verdicts particularly despised among jurists and judges, false acquittals, acquittals in favor of guilty people. Actually, in his 2016 book, The Lost Flows, he developed those old speculations to estimate the rate of false acquittals the US legal system generates. To that aim, he developed a combination of conceptual analysis and empirical data based on a series of statistical research results concerning the violent crime situation in the US in 2008. As mentioned earlier, I am focusing on false acquittals after trial. Loudon found that in 2008, in the 45,000 cases of violent crimes that went to trial, 30,000 defendants were convicted and 15,000 were acquitted. As we will see, Loudon holds that the system produces between 75% and 85% of false acquittals in the total amount of acquittals at trial, around 12,000 acquittals of the 15,000 total of acquittals. This is the basis of the failure thesis. To justify this claim, he takes several argumentative steps. The first one, he starts from what he calls a thesis of conventional wisdom, according to which the majority of defendants acquitted at trial are probably factually guilty. These defendants, he says, wouldn't even be going to trial unless the prosecutor believed that he had a strong chance of persuading jurors that these defendants were guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. End of the quote. This conventional wisdom, Loudon says, enjoys a prima facie plausibility, even if it does not involve empirical evidence. This plausibility lies in a speculation about the prudential rationality of prosecutors, according to which, even if the prosecutor sometimes overestimates the strength of his case against the defendant, it seems reasonable to suppose that most defendants winning an acquittal at trial have an apparent guilt in the range from about 70% to 90%. In such circumstances, that means, at minimum, either that the prosecutor is an obscenely bad judge of the strength of his case, or that the jury concluded that the defendant is probably guilty, but the evidence is too weak to warrant a conviction. End of the quote. It is pretty evident that here Loudon is taken for granted that the degree of prosecutor's confidence covariated with the evidence they had at hand, and this would be a case of the confusion error. Nevertheless, fortunately, the argument does not rest on speculation born from a mix of conventional wisdom and a conjecture as to what degree of confidence would be prudentially rational for a prosecutor to achieve before bringing a case to trial. Indeed, in 2016, his hunch is underpinned by empirical data, or at least Loudon yearns for this. He says that there are two powerful reasons for thinking that this simplistic assumption, the conventional wisdom thesis, understates the frequency of guilt among those acquitted at trial. Let's see these two powerful reasons. First, Loudon resorts to empirical data from Scotland, where Bard is in force and there are three possible criminal verdicts rather than two. After a trial, a defendant in Scotland could be declared guilty, not guilty, or guilt not proven. This last verdict plays a crucial role in Loudon's argumentation, given that in his understanding of this third verdict, it could be issued at any time. One, the jury is persuaded that the defendant is factually guilty, that is, the probability of guilt is more than 50%, but two, the jury is not convinced of that guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. End of the quote. As stated in a study of criminal prosecutions carried out by the Scottish government between 2005 and 2006, 71% of defendants tried for homicide and acquitted during that term received a verdict of guilt not proven. That means, Loudon says, that about 7 in 10 acquittals for murder in Scotland involved defendants regarded by the jurors as having probably committed the crime. And then, Loudon says, they were guilty. Let us assume that Loudon's understanding of the guilt not proven verdict is sound. Let us assume as well that Loudon does, as Loudon does, the unreasonable expectation that 71% of not proven cases in Scotland is a relevant sample and extensible to criminal cases for violent crimes decided in the US during 2008. After that, the second powerful reason, after that, Loudon refers to a study by Calvin and Cecil, the American jury, from 1966, as empirical evidence of the rate of false acquittals at trial. Part of this study consisted of asking judges about the jury's decisions in every trial they attended, 1,191 cases from the first 60s. Following Loudon's reconstruction, the researcher's question, the relevant question, was whether, in the opinion of the judge, the case was close, meaning the apparent guilt of the acquitted defendant verged on proof beyond a reasonable doubt, or whether it was clear acquittal, meaning that the defendant's apparent guilt was well below Bart, the Bart standard. End of the quote. When interviewed in 1960, the judges responded that, in their opinion, only 5% of the total amount of cases resulted in clear acquittals, while 52% were clear for conviction. Now, let's take, again questionably, these interviews as a relevant sample extensible to our framework, 45,000 cases from 2008 in US. Loudon says that given that US statistics from 2008 indicate that about one-third of the total trials for violent crimes resulted in acquittal, this, quoting Loudon, would seem to entail that only about 15% of the acquittals are clearly acquittals, while some 85% are, in the opinion of the presiding judge, close cases. End of the quote. Now, Loudon does not make the reasoning leading to this conclusion explicit. However, it seemed to be as follows. If just 5% of the cases are clear acquittals, as a surprising generalization of 1960s Calvin and Cecil interviews, it is possible to conjecture, Loudon seemingly deems, that only 2,250 violent crimes, cases decided in 2008, should have been clear cases to acquit, just the 5% of the 45,000 cases under consideration. Nevertheless, according to the statistics, the number of acquittals was 15,000. Ergo, Loudon holds, only 15% of acquittal were clear, decided cases. Moreover, Loudon asserts that we can assume, in virtue of Calvin and Cecil's study, that more than 12,000 of defendants are close enough to warrant an assumption that these are probably factually guilty, even if their apparent guilt fails to eliminate all reasonable doubts. End of the quote. The following step in the argument is to combine Scottish data with the Calvin and Cecil results in order to get a midpoint and then apply this to the 2008 US statistics. It seems, Loudon says, it seems fair to say that most of those acquitted at trial of a violent crime were nonetheless regarded by the jurors and judges as probably guilty and thereby are reasonably assumed to be false negatives. Accordingly, I shall hereafter assume that among those 15,000 acquittals that emerge in trials for violent crimes in the US in 2008, some, 75%, were false negatives. End of the quote. Well, there are plenty of surprising steps in these arguments. However, for present purposes, the most crucial point is his claim that between 75% and 85% of defendants have been acquitted despite the appearance of guilt being higher than 50%. Even more, Loudon states that Bart is responsible for that 75% or 80% of false acquittals due to its excessive demand for evidence. One more quote. Viewed from this perspective, it is vividly clear that the current standard of proof is too high. As I have already shown, the promiscuous acquittal of many very probably guilty defendants because their apparent guilt is perceived as below the Bart standard is generating much more harm than the occasional conviction of innocent defendants does. End of the quote. The alleged verification of this flaw, of this 75 or 80 or 85% of false acquittals, the failure thesis, constitutes an empirical basis for Loudon to encourage a reduction in the epistemic exigence of the standard of proof. However, I will try to show now that this failure thesis is unacceptable. I have four reasons for this rejection. The first one, a non-existent threshold cannot be too high. One way to determine if a standard of proof in force is epistemically too demanding would be to pre-identify the exact threshold of evidence the standard requires. However, according to Loudon's Confucian thesis, this is not possible when the standard of proof in force is barred. On the one hand, it is extremely ambiguous formula. On the other, and more relevant to our purpose, the common understanding of the formula, as Loudon shows, turn it into a travesty system of proof, a fake epistemic criterion. This is what would happen, especially with attempts to articulate the standard in probabilistic terms. As Loudon taught us, no covariation between the degree of confidence and the degree of epistemic justification is ever warranted. Therefore, the opinion of judges, jurors, or citizens in general about the degree of confidence that the hypothesis of guilt ought to achieve to convict, according to Bart, says absolutely nothing about the epistemic demand it entails. And this is where I see the inconsistency between the Confucian thesis and the failure thesis. However, there is a way around this obstacle. It is possible to avoid inconsistency in defending the Confucian thesis and the failure thesis at the same time. After all, one could claim that even prove that although Bart leads to confusion between the degree of confidence and the degree of epistemic justification, the system produces too many false acquittals. The way of proving this last claim would be showing that it happens to be that in a particular legal system, in a specific community, the triers of fact only convict in cases where there is a massive amount of evidence. And that conversely, in many other cases, they acquit the defendant, although the evidence of guilt was quite good. In other words, it could be possible to prove that actually triers of fact get Bart's subjective confidence only in cases in which evidence is abundant. However, it is precisely here where Loudon's error becomes serious, given the inappropriate grounds of his argument. The first problem regards the invocation of reasons of the wrong sort, and the second one concerns the absence of reasons of the right sort. Why Loudon's argument is a case of wrong sort of reasons argument. The first problem concerns the reasons Loudon invokes to infer the rate of false acquittals he claims the system generates. Indeed, He adopts an entirely subjective standard of proof formulated in terms of probabilities. And by doing so, he falls into the very same flaw he had been criticizing. Namely, he assumes, with no apparent reason at all, that subjective confidence expressed in the interviews employing degrees of probabilities, close to Bard and therefore close to 90%, covariates with the degree of epistemic justification, with the appearance of guilt of each defendant. From this, he concludes that there was an epistemic probability higher than 50% to support a conviction verdict in every case in the sample. Then he falls into the confusion error. Degrees of confidence about a proposition P, which are self-attributed, are not the right sort of reason to accept that proposition as true. We should recall here, paradoxically, Loudon's lesson about assigning probability degrees of two beliefs. If assigning probabilistic degrees of confidence can be irrational when a probabilistic interpretation of Bard is at stake, the same has to be said when assigning probabilistic degrees of confidence which are allegedly verged on Bard, close to Bard. This also remains open to the devastating criticism that it confuses mere strength of belief with warranted belief. And this brings us to the second type of problem. The absence of reasons of the right sort. To defend the failure thesis without failing into the wrong sort of reasons problem, the claim that in most of the acquitted cases the defendant was actually guilty should be appropriately justified. The justification of this claim requires a necessary but insufficient condition, to wit, bringing the evidence underpinning the defendant's guilt to the fore. We can now see why Loudon's failure thesis turns out to be unacceptable. The only proper grounds to claim that a certain number of acquitted defendants were probably guilty would be the evidence against each one of those defendants. Loudon fails to provide any evidence to encourage us to believe that not even in one of the cases of acquittal he takes under consideration, there were good epistemic reasons to believe in guilt. This lack of reasons of the right kind should be enough to reject not only his failure thesis, but also his political program of decreasing evidentiary requirement to convict people. However, there is an additional reason for this rejection that I have called the evaluative disagreement. Let us suppose that Bard is in force and that it actually requires 90% of confidence in a defendant's guilt to secure a conviction. Let us also imagine that in our community, in this community, people is infallibly rational from the epistemic point of view, one community in which the degree of confidence in factual propositions, in the truth of factual propositions, covariates with the degree of epistemic justification in each case. And we can assume also that epistemic justification is, by hypothesis, also quantifiable. Let us even suppose that for every case decided in that community, in our ideal community, it is entirely possible to contrast all the evidence fact finders had in order to make a decision and every epistemic inference they drew. Now, let us assume that of the total amount of acquittals after a trial in criminal cases in that community, there is a very high rate, let us say 85%, favoring defendants whose guilt was proven between, say, 60% and 89%. Even under these circumstances, to claim that the rate of false acquittals in this epistemically ideal community is of 85% would be, to say the least, unacceptable, since the claim would be the outcome of merely and dubiously applying a less demanding standard of proof than the one in force in the criminal legal system. This argumentative strategy would be a piece of trickery. In the end, it is just the result of a merely evaluative disagreement. So to conclude, The two worries central to Larry Loudon's contribution to legal evidential reasoning are the radical arbitrariness of Bard formula and the irrational number of false negatives given the exaggerated requirements of the standard. As I have tried to demonstrate, there is something wrong in the way he sets out these worries. To insist that the standard is subjective and arbitrary, to label it as a travesty and a fake system of proof, seems inconsistent with saying that the standard is both excessively demanding from an epistemic point of view and that it is responsible for a certain number of false negatives. Furthermore, his argument for claiming that the system produces too many false acquittals is unacceptable, and not just because of this inconsistency. The main reasons are as follows. On the one hand, Loudon himself confuses presumptively strength of belief of jurors or judges with warranted belief. And on the other hand, he fails to provide evidence showing that the defendants acquitted were materially guilty. Thank you so much.